civilian rule in South Vietnam ended, never to return. Taylor reported that Qua, the quiet and unassuming physician who had tried to heal South Vietnam's destructive divisions, had fallen prey to jugular vein politics in Saigon. Air Vice Marshal Ky took over as Prime Minister. As the Saigon government faltered and the Viet Cong summer offensive gathered momentum, the president and his advisors remained ambivalent about how U.S. military force ought to be used in Vietnam and, indeed, for what purpose. On Saturday, June 5th, McNamara, Rusk, Ball, Llewellyn Thompson, McNaughton, and the Bundy brothers met for an across-the-board discussion on Vietnam. About 2 hours into the meeting, LBJ joined his advisors, unannounced and appearing confused. The questions that he posed revealed that he had not fully considered the dynamics or the consequences of his decisions to escalate the war effort to its current level. He asked, "Who sees our purpose and means of achieving it out there?" He wondered, "Will it be so costly? How do we expect to win?" Johnson remained equally concerned about the possibility of a protracted commitment complicating his bid for re-election in 1968. Referring to Eisenhower's 1952 presidential campaign vow to end the Korean War, Johnson asked, "How do you expect to wind things up? You'll get, 'I'll go to Korea.'" Although it may have seemed that McNamara had moderated his enthusiasm for graduated pressure to help the president fend off recommendations for an intensification of Rolling Thunder, the Secretary of Defense remained hopeful that U.S. military power could coerce North Vietnam into giving away at the negotiating table what policy constraints and the nature of the war would not permit U.S. forces to achieve on the battlefield. He concluded that the deterioration of the military situation in South Vietnam had made achieving a military stalemate in the South as important as causing pain in the North. Rusk agreed, stating that U.S. military force would simply have to demonstrate to the other side that they could not win without a major escalation of the war. He said that although Hanoi's response might be only to stop infiltration and emphasize political rather than military means of unifying the country under its leadership, at least they would have abandoned their current strategy of pursuing victory in the short term. According to Rusk, the objective of U.S. military force would be to force a return to the situation that had existed in 1958, when the South Vietnamese government battled an indigenous guerrilla force that did not have the benefit of extensive support from the North. Ball concurred, adding only that the United States had to present Hanoi with an opportunity to end the war through negotiation. The meeting ended with the president and his advisors hoping that they could carry through in Vietnam with the 82,000 U.S. troops that the president had already approved on April 22nd. Before LBJ left his advisors, he mused that the great danger is that we'll pick up a very big problem any day. That day arrived 48 hours later. On June 7th, General Westmoreland sent a cable to SINCPAC requesting more American troops and permission to use them to locate and destroy Vietnamese communist forces in the South. He argued that in light of recent Viet Cong successes and the ominous presence of North Vietnamese army units in the South, the South Vietnamese armed forces were near collapse. To avert disaster, he requested an immediate increase of 41,000 troops. Later, he would need an additional 52,000, bringing the total to 175,000. The total would comprise 34 maneuver battalions, 22 Army and 12 Marine, along with combat support battalions and additional Navy and Air Force units. Westmoreland also requested the immediate deployment of 10 additional battalions of South Korean and Australian troops. If those third country units were not forthcoming, he asked that the United States make up the shortfall, increasing the number of U.S. troops to approximately 200,000, or 44 battalions. The number of troops Westmoreland requested was more than 2.5 times larger than the limit the president had approved on April 22nd. Westmoreland planned to position the forces both along the coast and inland, and to use them both offensively and defensively. He recalled later that there would be no more niceties about defensive posture and reaction. It was time to forget about enclaves and take the war to the enemy. Even as he received Westmoreland's request, the president remained determined to conceal the depth of American intervention. Astute reporters had discerned the shift in U.S. ground forces' mission from defensive security to offensive operations. Although the president had authorized the change on April 13th, he had ordered that it be kept secret. Since that time, civilian and military officials had made misleading statements to obscure the change of mission. On June 8th, a reporter asked Robert McCloskey, Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs, about the mission of American ground troops in South Vietnam. McCloskey, who felt that his reputation and the credibility of the State Department were at risk, responded that U.S. forces would be used in offensive combat operations. An editorial in the next morning's New York Times expressed disbelief that the American people were told by a minor State Department official yesterday that, in effect, they were in a land war on the continent of Asia. The nation is informed about it, not by the president, not by a cabinet member, not even by a sub-cabinet official, but by a public relations officer. Despite McCloskey's indiscretion, the president was still resolved to conceal the change of mission. After the New York Times editorial appeared, White House Press Secretary George Reedy met reporters to issue a brief statement. "There has been no change in the mission of U.S. ground combat units in Vietnam in recent days or weeks. The president has issued no order of any kind in this regard to General Westmoreland recently or at any other time. The primary mission of these troops is to secure and safeguard important military installations like the airfield at Da Nang. They have the associated mission of active patrolling and securing action in and near the areas thus safeguarded." Reedy allowed only that General Westmoreland had authority to assist beleaguered South Vietnamese units if the general military situation requires it. In response to a question, he told the reporters for background that the discrepancy between his statement and McCloskey's the day before was due to certain speculative matters and certain contingencies which are inherent in the situation that came out the other end as though these were decisions which had been taken and orders which had been issued. Westmoreland, although confused by the White House statement, remained more interested in obtaining permission to take wider military action than in questioning the president's effort to mask the nature of American involvement in the war. He reassured Honolulu, the SINCPAC headquarters, and Washington that he saw no difficulty explaining U.S. offensive operations as consistent with Reedy's statement that U.S. troops were in South Vietnam to guard military bases. He stated that American offensive operations were already underway, and the South Vietnamese now expect and anticipate this kind of participation. He observed that, "We have reached a point in Vietnam where we cannot avoid the commitment to combat of U.S. ground troops, because the South Vietnamese can no longer cope alone with Vietnamese communist forces." Sharp supported Westmoreland's approach. He told Westmoreland to proceed with the battalion-sized operations that Westmoreland was planning for the 173rd Airborne Brigade, but warned him to be cautious. I'm sure you realize that there would be grave political implications involved if sizable U.S. forces are committed for the first time and suffer a defeat. On June 8th, Ambassador Taylor arrived in Washington for another round of consultations with the president and his principal advisors. Westmoreland's troop request dominated the discussions. Taylor's resistance to additional troop deployments and to State Department negotiating proposals had further diminished his popularity among top administration officials. He was due to leave his position in the late summer or fall. Bundy, however, thought that the sooner Taylor left, the better. Taylor opposed Westmoreland's troop request, but, consistent with his compromise with McNamara at the Honolulu conference, he merely proposed a smaller number of troops. He suggested that the situation in South Vietnam was not as bad as Westmoreland had reported. Instead of the 85,000 additional troops that Westmoreland had estimated would eventually become necessary, Taylor recommended that the president consider deploying 8,000 troops beyond the 82,000 already authorized. In response to Taylor's proposal, Wheeler told the president that the JCS supported Westmoreland's request in full. McNamara and McGeorge Bundy argued that 18,000 more troops, which would bring the total number of American troops in Vietnam to 100,000, was most appropriate. Ball pointed out that the number of troops was not as important as how they affected the nature of American involvement in Vietnam. He asked, "When does this become a white man's war?" Ball's question begged a discussion of military strategy. It was still unclear whether American forces would remain in enclaves to provide security and serve as ready reaction forces, or whether they would engage in large-scale offensive operations aimed at finding and destroying the enemy. Taylor and Green favored the enclave concept, whereas Westmoreland and the other chiefs advocated aggressive offensive operations against enemy troop concentrations. A discussion of strategic options and analysis of their feasibility, however, did not occur. McNamara recommended that the president delay making a comprehensive assessment and deploy only enough troops to hold the situation together through the summer. Having decided to do only what was necessary to avert disaster, LBJ focused on how he would gain popular and congressional approval for his latest escalation of the war. The president met with his advisors once again on June 9th. His longtime friend and mentor, Senator Russell of Georgia, joined Rusk, McNamara, Ball, Vance, Rayburn, Reedy, and Moyers. The presence of Reedy and Moyers, as well as the absence of General Wheeler, facilitated discussion of the public relations war. Describing his area of disagreement with Westmoreland's request as limited, McNamara proposed that the president approve 18 additional battalions for South Vietnam, 16 short of the number Westmoreland had recommended. McNamara predicted that the smaller force would cover us until the end of the year. Later in the meeting, Johnson asked, "What do they, the military, want now?" McNamara replied, "More explanation." Ball attempted to delay a decision and reinforced McNamara's focus on a short-term, limited response to Westmoreland's request. He advised the president to be careful not to regard this decision as defining or pre-deciding what we can do after we see what happens. The president asked if anyone disagreed with McNamara's proposal. Rusk and McNamara reported that the senior people in state and defense agreed. After Johnson approved the deployment of 14 more battalions as a short-term expedient, the meeting evolved into a rehearsal for justifying the president's policy to critics. Anticipating public and congressional arguments against a further increase in the U.S. military commitment to South Vietnam, the president asked whether this latest escalation of the war would mean a land war in Asia. Taylor responded, "We have to explain that this is not that, not a Korean War." Johnson asked, "What is the answer to the argument that the bombing has had no results?" Rusk suggested, "We never thought that it would bring them running, and it has had a good military effect." Taylor added that the president might point to increased morale among the South Vietnamese. According to McGeorge Bundy's notes, LBJ put his advisors on notice that his reason for going north was to raise morale in the South. Johnson then summarized the arguments against his policy. He read from a memorandum that Senator Mansfield had sent him on June 5th, listing reasons against transforming Vietnam into an American war. Rather than explore the validity of Mansfield's objections, however, the president asked his advisors to answer the objections to deeper involvement line by line. The key, his advisors concluded, would be for the president to keep public relations pressure on left and right to prove that he was moving carefully. Responding to the president's need for support, senior officials in the Johnson administration had become more apologists than advisors. The president remained determined to deepen American involvement in Vietnam without a congressional debate. With Senator Russell listening, he asked if the administration had adequately described the mission of U.S. ground forces in South Vietnam. Rusk responded that they had. LBJ ordered Leonard Meeker, the State Department's legal advisor, and Attorney General Nicholas Katzenbach to prepare legal justifications under the Gulf of Tonkin resolution for McNamara's proposed troop increase. Even as he circumvented the Constitution, LBJ abdicated leadership in connection with Vietnam. The focus on justifying the president's middle course preserved confusion in strategic planning. When the president asked his advisors, "What is our objective?" some answered, "Stalemate in the South." Others hoped that military action against the North would coerce Hanoi into negotiations. The meeting ended without a clear answer to Johnson's question. Ball concluded that the short-range objective of holding on preempted further discussion. The president and his advisors hoped that, despite Westmoreland's estimate that at least 123,000 and probably 175,000 troops were needed, 95,000 would keep South Vietnam from disintegrating until September. Consideration of the consequences of deeper involvement was deferred. The president's advisors concluded that the additional troops should not get the U.S. into deep trouble. There was still room to pull back, or even out, if the Army of the Republic of Vietnam could not carry on. When the president asked what kind of losses U.S. ground troops might suffer, McNamara responded with a short-term estimate of another 400 between now and October. Although McNamara contrived to enjoy virtually unchallenged credibility as a brilliant analyst, it was unclear on what facts and interpretations he had based his estimate. Without a clear idea of the objective, the military strategy under which U.S. forces would operate remained unclear as well. When the president asked McNamara, "What are we doing with the 95,000 troops?" he responded, "Not too much," and offered general need as justification. In opposition to Westmoreland's concept for expanding offensive operations, Taylor emphasized the strike reserve proposal that he had advocated in March. He linked the air campaign to the troop increase with the vague observation that they were complementary. McNamara faced the challenge of explaining to the JCS the decision to grant only a portion of Westmoreland's request. After he returned to his Pentagon office, the Defense Secretary telephoned the president. McNamara recognized the incompatibility between the president's desire to take the middle approach and pursue a stalemate in the near term, and the Joint Chiefs' belief that, once committed, the United States should apply the level of force necessary to defeat Vietnamese communist forces. McNamara told the president that, in the back of my mind, I have a very definite limitation on commitment in mind, and I don't think the chiefs do. In fact, I know they don't. LBJ asked, do you think that the Westmoreland request is just the next step with them up the ladder? Yes, McNamara responded. They hope they don't have to go any further, but Westmoreland outlines in his cable the step beyond it, and he doesn't say that's the last. McNamara, however, neither communicated to the chiefs the limitation on commitment, nor asked them what might be achieved with the additional troops or what strategy was appropriate to that level of force. Wheeler first became aware of the president's decision to commit only those troops necessary to hold on through the summer at a June 11th National Security Council meeting. The meeting, designed to build consensus behind the president's decision, included Wheeler, McNamara, McNaughton, Rusk, Ball, Rayburn, Katzenbach, UN Ambassador Adlai Stevenson, Reedy, the Bundy brothers, and several other officials. Beginning the meeting with an explanation of the legal justification for his policy under the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, Johnson limited the scope of the discussion to ways of holding the situation. Taylor, who had agreed to McNamara's force ceiling of 100,000 troops, minimized the difficulty of the situation in South Vietnam. He told the audience that the present VC campaign will be terminated without serious losses. After preliminary remarks that put Westmoreland's request in the context of a difficult but far from desperate situation in Vietnam, McNamara misrepresented its scale. He ignored the second portion, a total of 34 battalions and 175,000 troops, stating instead that Westmoreland recommends that the 13 battalions authorized be increased to 23 battalions, 123,000 men. McNamara highlighted divisions among the chiefs to suggest that they did not fully support Westmoreland's request or his advocacy of an aggressive war against the Viet Cong. He claimed that the chiefs opposed the deployment of U.S. forces in the central highlands of South Vietnam and wanted the new forces to be used as a mobile reserve near the coast. Wheeler quietly challenged both Taylor's depiction of the situation and McNamara's portrayal of the JCS position. He stated that chiefs are impressed by General Westmoreland's presentation of the need for more U.S. forces. The Defense Department's proposal calls for deploying fewer troops now than either General Westmoreland or the Joint Chiefs recommend. The chiefs favor taking a decision now on sending the number of troops recommended by General Westmoreland. The McNamara plan would send fewer forces now and keep our options open to send additional forces later. Wheeler's effort was futile. The decision had already been made. The president closed the meeting with the following statement. We must delay and deter the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong as much as we can and as simply as we can, without going all out. When we grant General Westmoreland's request, it means that we get in deeper, and it is harder to get out. They think they are winning, and we think they are. We must determine which course gives us the maximum protection at the least cost. The president had used the logic of graduated pressure to rationalize his continued pursuit of a policy that would allow him to maintain a consensus. William Bundy recalled that Johnson had decided to try to keep the middle ground. Just what this meant in terms of U.S. forces was not spelled out or decided. As the president spoke of keeping his options open, two Viet Cong regiments were overrunning the U.S. Special Forces camp at Dong Xuai and inflicting another disastrous defeat on the South Vietnamese Army. The middle ground that the president had occupied for so long was crumbling beneath him. Despite his recognition that his advisors had no plan for victory militarily or diplomatically, Lyndon Johnson remained resolved to do only what was necessary to avoid defeat in Vietnam. Fixated on short-term expedience and lacking a comprehensive estimate of what the war might cost the United States in the long term, the president focused on the more easily discernible price of withdrawal. Pulling out, Johnson confided to his most trusted advisors, made him shudder to think what all of them would say. As Johnson approved additional troop deployments to prevent defeat in the South, he continued to defer a decision on the fundamental nature of his policy. LBJ told Ball that he wanted to keep his options open until after the monsoon season, when he planned to get an appreciation for congressional sentiments in connection with Vietnam. After September, Johnson hoped to forge a united front in Congress behind his policy. Ball suggested that Johnson keep new troop deployments to a minimum so he could keep the power of decision and keep control. With each troop deployment, however, Johnson was sinking the United States deeper into what his old friend Clifford had described as a quagmire. On June 18th, the president formally approved a portion of Westmoreland's request. The Air Mobile 1st Cavalry Division, 9 battalions, 23,000 troops, would be sent to South Vietnam. Depending on the situation, two brigades already approved for deployment might withdraw sometime in the future. Consistent with McNamara's recommendation of 1 week earlier, if those brigades were to remain, 23 battalions, 123,000 troops, would be committed to South Vietnam. The JCS had found the 23-battalion force level acceptable because McNamara promised to consider leaving in South Vietnam the battalions marked for possible withdrawal. Westmoreland, however, protested. He thought unrealistic McNamara's suggestion that 123,000 U.S. troops represented an upper threshold of our ground commitment, and that thereafter a cut of 3 to 6 battalions might be enforced. Westmoreland reminded Sharp and Wheeler of his belief that extraordinary measures were necessary just to stabilize the situation, and that more combat strength would probably be required to carry the war to the enemy. Westmoreland disagreed with McNamara's argument that the piecemeal approval of his request had provided the MACV commander with maximum flexibility. McNamara kept the military on the president's team. While hiding from them his determination to keep the U.S. commitment sharply limited. To help the president steer a middle course, McNamara began to develop a program aimed at achieving a stalemate in Vietnam. By definition, McNamara's objective did not entail compelling the enemy to accept terms favorable to U.S. interests. American involvement in the war continued to escalate in a vacuum of strategic thought and without a clear plan of action aimed at achieving decisive results. McNamara recalled that at the end of June 1965, Lyndon Johnson felt tortured and was deeply torn over what to do about Vietnam. The president had finally begun to recognize the consequences of the decisions he had made during the previous 5 months. He had discovered that once Americans were committed to direct combat in the air against the North and on the ground in the South, he had no option but to continue to deepen American intervention and assume even greater responsibility for the war effort. The rationale of graduated pressure that incremental intensifications of the war were reversible and therefore could be pursued at low cost, had committed the United States to war before Johnson had given himself and the country an opportunity to decide whether that commitment would be in the interest of the United States. Blinded by his desire to pass the Great Society legislative program, the president had found Vietnam a nuisance that he hoped would go away. Sensing LBJ's desire for an easy answer to what seemed an intractable problem, his most trusted civilian advisors gave Johnson what he wanted. The Joint Chiefs of Staff, moreover, let the assumptions on which the president's policy was based go unchallenged and chose instead to work within his constraints in an effort to intensify the war effort by degrees. By the end of June, however, the path of least resistance had left Lyndon Johnson at a dead end. He had used rhetoric equating opposition to his policy with the abandonment of American soldiers on the front lines. If he rejected military requests for additional forces, those same charges could be leveled against him. In the next weeks, LBJ's series of small decisions on ground troops would push the number of troops approved for deployment to South Vietnam over 120,000. Decisions made from the beginning of Op Plan 34A operations in January 1964 through the first airstrikes against North Vietnam in response to the real or imagined Gulf of Tonkin incidents, to the incremental decisions of February through June 1965, had already committed the United States to war. By July 1965, it was no longer a question of whether the United States would deepen its involvement in Vietnam, but how the president would reconcile the demands of war with those of the Great Society. Chapter 15, Five Silent Men, July 1965. What the military officer isn't taught is how to cope with the accommodation required in the political process. There must be clearer and more rigid standards for the man in uniform, whose responsibility ends in human life, in contrast to standards for the man in civilian clothes, who does not face the specter of death in his mind as he deliberates on actions that might be taken. General Harold K. Johnson, 1973. As George Ball made one last futile attempt to prevent what had already become an American war in Vietnam, the president continued to rely on McNamara to maintain consensus behind his pursuit of the middle ground. On June 23rd, Ball recommended that the United States cut its losses in Vietnam. When McNamara and Rusk opposed this proposal and argued for deepening American military involvement, the president directed that McNamara and Ball put their views in writing. Before the memos were complete, however, McNamara persuaded Ball to abandon his radical proposal for withdrawal in favor of a proposal that the United States minimize its liabilities by limiting troop deployments to 72,000 and restricting their combat role. Bombing would continue, but the area around Hanoi and Haiphong would remain off limits. McNamara, arguing that Ball's paper was unacceptable because it did not offer a good way out, received assistance from Rusk, who predicted that pulling out of Vietnam would damage U.S. credibility, which is the pillar of peace throughout the world. Rusk argued that such a diminution of American reputation would lead to our ruin and almost certainly to catastrophic war. With Ball's dangerous paper suppressed, McNamara continued to build consensus behind the proposal that he was developing in the Pentagon. McNamara told McNaughton to outline a political and military scenario for American intervention in Vietnam. Following the president's instructions to include the smallest group possible in the planning effort in order to minimize the possibility of leaks, the Defense Secretary asked the Joint Staff to develop a list of specific military actions that could be taken in Vietnam, but did not permit the JCS themselves to participate in higher-level discussions concerning policy or strategic options. Indeed, McNamara, with Wheeler's assistance, kept the other chiefs in the dark about the latest planning effort. Although McNamara ostensibly included Wheeler in this process, he excluded the general from substantive deliberations by lying to him about the subject of meetings with Ball, Rusk, McGeorge Bundy, McNaughton, and others. With the Joint Staff providing only technical advice and the JCS shut out of policy meetings, the list of military actions were consistent with the President's call to kill more Viet Cong. And so the discussions emphasized tactics and means rather than strategy and the end state desired in Vietnam. Overlooking the complexities of countering the political and military challenges of defeating an insurgency, military operations were aimed at killing large numbers of the enemy in conventional battles and at hounding, harassing, and hurting the Viet Cong should they elect not to stand and fight. The report requested more troop deployments and emphasized the tactic of launching 800 B-52 strikes against Viet Cong havens and following up each air raid with a prompt entry of ground forces into the struck area. The latest planning effort continued to equate any activity with progress rather than providing a vision for ending the war on terms favorable to the United States. These expanded military and political moves, McNamara wrote to LBJ, would convince North Vietnam and the Viet Cong that the odds are against their winning. By default, attrition had become the military strategy, and stalemate was its objective. Even as he excluded the JCS from policy discussions, McNamara remained committed to keeping the chiefs on the team. He retained in his paper the full list of military actions developed by the Joint Staff, even though it included military measures that went far beyond the limitations he envisioned. In the first draft of his paper on the expansion of U.S. military pressure, McNamara recommended the deployment of 40 battalions to raise the number of U.S. troops to 200,000. Consistent with JCS plans for mobilization, the paper suggested a reserve call-up of 100,000 and the extension of tours of duty for those already in the service. The paper also proposed expanding the air campaign against North Vietnam, including bombing port facilities, mining harbors, destroying transportation and industrial targets closer to Hanoi, and intensifying aerial interdiction. Aircraft would attack North Vietnamese airfields and surface-to-air missile sites as necessary. But McNamara never genuinely considered advocating the measures that the Joint Staff had recommended. McGeorge Bundy, who thought that the principal purpose of ground troops would be to preserve American credibility by covering an eventual retreat, criticized the military actions contained in McNamara's paper as rash to the point of folly. McNamara responded that he would be more than willing to abandon controversial military recommendations, noting, however, that the Joint Chiefs of Staff are strongly in favor of going even further. McNamara appeased the JCS by keeping his memo unchanged, while, by privately professing a willingness to drop military recommendations, he preserved the support of McGeorge Bundy and Rusk, who favored limited military actions. Although William Bundy described the last week in June as the time for pleadings, the president's advisors settled their differences out of court. Before the president met with his advisors on July 1st, McGeorge Bundy sent him a memorandum to which he attached the Vietnam policy papers from McNamara and Ball and from Rusk and William Bundy. Rusk's paper highlighted the damage to U.S. credibility that would attend a withdrawal from Vietnam, and William Bundy proposed that the administration limit additional troop deployments while waiting to see what happens. McGeorge Bundy advised Johnson to listen hard to George Ball and then reject his proposal. Bundy suggested that Johnson then choose between McNamara's and William Bundy's options and told the president that McNamara was willing to tone down the recommendations in his paper. 2 days before McGeorge Bundy forwarded the advisor's memos to the president, however, LBJ had rendered Ball's and William Bundy's recommendations irrelevant to the current situation by approving the immediate deployment to Vietnam of 3 additional Marine units comprising 11,000 men in response to an urgent request from Westmoreland. With the pattern of slowly deepening American military involvement in Vietnam well established, the president attempted to build support within his administration, in Congress, and among the public. On July 2nd, as more U.S. Marines landed at Da Nang and Quy Nhon, Johnson met with his closest advisors. To protect the consensus they had reached around McNamara's toned-down recommendation for further military action, McNamara and Rusk wanted the meeting kept small because, according to McGeorge Bundy, they felt strongly that the George Ball paper should not be argued with you in any audience larger than yourself, Rusk, McNamara, Ball, and me. They feel that it is exceedingly dangerous to have this possibility reported in a wide circle. Moreover, both of them feel great reticence about expressing their innermost thoughts to you in front of any larger group. Johnson, however, was already following the consensus that McNamara had worked to contrive. To build further support for his decision to gradually introduce more troops into South Vietnam while maintaining the sharp limitations on the use of force against the North, McNamara would travel to Saigon in mid-July for further consideration of Westmoreland's request. The JCS, with whom McNamara had last met on June 28th, had no influence over the administration's response to Westmoreland's request. Even as the Joint Staff worked with McNaughton, Wheeler kept the service chiefs ignorant of the McNamara memo until it was completed. Wheeler was determined to give Westmoreland his unqualified support and present McNamara with a unified view from the chiefs, and Green, who preferred the enclave strategy to Westmoreland's concept of offensive action aimed at destroying concentrations of Vietnamese communist forces, might have complicated Wheeler's effort. When Green discovered on June 28th that he and his colleagues had been kept uninformed about the McNamara memo for nearly a week, he concluded that Joint Chiefs of Staff influence had reached a new low. Despite Green's disappointment, however, service parochialism continued to undermine the chief's ability to cooperate on urgent matters of national security. Admiral Sharp, who was in Washington for a brief visit, warned Green that General Westmoreland and Ambassador Taylor do not like Marines and will do everything they can to prevent the Marine Corps from getting credit for their accomplishments in South Vietnam. Green's conversation with Sharp turned him toward improving press coverage of Marine Corps actions rather than evaluating the decision to deploy more troops. Believing that the war would require up to 3 times as many troops as the president was currently considering, the JCS, meanwhile, continued to advocate incremental troop deployments. Harold Johnson estimated that to guarantee a free and independent South Vietnam would take 600,000 to 700,000 troops and 5 years of fighting. Wallace Green's figure also went as high as 700,000. General Johnson recalled that despite their personal estimates, the JCS never made a recommendation for the total force. In addition, the chief's disagreements on how to use U.S. military force went unheard and unresolved. As the president enlarged the American commitment in Vietnam, he had yet to hear from his military advisors concerning how the U.S. military would fight the war, or how many troops it might take to force a settlement consistent with the stated policy goal of maintaining the freedom and independence of South Vietnam. In a July 10th meeting with the JCS, McNamara told the chiefs that the president had decided to move forward in South Vietnam, but had not yet decided on a specific course of action. He warned the JCS to keep what he was about to tell them out of the news. He divulged that the president had, on July 8th, approved the deployment to South Vietnam of the full 34 battalions that Westmoreland had requested. The total force of more than 200,000 would be in South Vietnam by November 1st. After making the announcement, McNamara reviewed the details of the impending mobilization and deployment. The Marine Corps would mobilize a 4th Marine Division, an air wing, and add 3 new brigades of 3 battalions each to the force structure. The reserve and newly formed units would be combat ready within 4 to 6 months. The Army would call up 27 reserve battalions and, to replace eventually the reserve units, would organize another 27 regular Army battalions from scratch. If the need existed, the reserves might remain on active duty. McNamara told the chiefs that the first priority would be to get troops into South Vietnam as fast as they can be absorbed. All that remained, he said, was the formal announcement of the decision. The Congress and the American public, however, would have to be softened up. Public relations, McNamara told the chiefs, was the principal reason for his impending trip to South Vietnam. Green found McNamara's announcement astonishing. He thought that the requirement for additional forces and the deployment of both regulars and reserves had not been carefully thought through. Green recorded at the time that McNamara conducted the JCS meeting in a condescending and impatient manner. He left Green with the impression that the chiefs had become technicians whose principal responsibility was to carry out decisions already made, rather than fully participating in the planning and advisory process. While preparing deployment plans and a concept for how to use U.S. forces, McNamara and Wheeler bypassed the other members of the JCS. Green would not discover until July 12th that, since July 2nd, an ad hoc committee under Goodpaster's direction had been charged by Wheeler with determining what assurance the U.S. can have of winning if we do everything we can. As Goodpaster's committee scrambled to develop a military strategy for Vietnam, civilian officials in the Department of Defense made the effort frivolous. Although McNamara had told the president that he had a very definite limitation on commitment in mind, he did not tell Goodpaster or the JCS that such a constraint existed, lest the chiefs balk at explicit limitations. After he arrived in Saigon, McNamara asked Westmoreland whether, based on the assumption that enemy efforts did not increase, 34 U.S. battalions would suffice to prove to the Viet Cong and the Democratic Republic of Vietnam that they cannot win in South Vietnam. Although he had assumed away the possibility of an enemy response to an American buildup and limited the military objective to stalemate, McNamara did not get the answer he wanted. Implicitly rejecting stalemate as a military objective, Westmoreland argued that the enemy was too deeply committed to be influenced by anything but the application of overpowering force. Even the full level of force that Westmoreland had requested would not per se caused the enemy to back off. Westmoreland told McNamara that, instinctively, we believe that there may be substantial additional U.S. force requirements. After the forces included in his request had stabilized the military situation, Westmoreland intended to use unspecified numbers of additional troops in 1966 to gain and maintain the military initiative. Even though McNamara had hoped to exact from Westmoreland an estimate of the number of troops needed to impose a stalemate, Westmoreland sought an open-ended commitment to the objective of overwhelming the enemy. McNamara's guidance to Goodpaster's group clearly revealed that civilian and military officials were going to war with dramatically different objectives in mind. McNamara and McNaughton, who continued to define the policy goal as maintaining U.S. credibility and prestige, envisioned achieving that goal by pursuing the military objective of stalemate in South Vietnam. In a July 2nd memo that he had cleared with McNamara, McNaughton suggested to Goodpaster that, to win in Vietnam, the United States would merely have to succeed in demonstrating to the VC that they cannot win. A stalemate, McNaughton suggested, would be tantamount to victory if it served as a way station along toward a favorable settlement. Goodpaster did not take McNaughton seriously and continued to develop plans based on the stated policy goal of maintaining a stable and independent non-communist government in South Vietnam. He established objectives that would require larger forces and fewer restrictions on military planning and operations than McNaughton and McNamara envisioned. Goodpaster urged the destruction of the war-supporting power of North Vietnam and the defeat of Viet Cong and North Vietnamese main force units in the South. Military action would not impose a stalemate as a way station to negotiations, but force the enemy to stop the war or render them incapable of continuing it. Goodpaster recalled that he had taken special care to make clear that the proposal was based on avoiding a stalemate. He did not, however, directly confront McNamara and McNaughton over what were apparent, if not explicit, disparities in the objectives pursued by military and civilian officials, which underlay recommendations of vastly different levels of force. Although McNamara implied that Goodpaster's study group should limit the scope of military actions it recommended, he failed to make explicit the limits and restrictions on the use of force that he had in mind. After a conversation with McNamara, McNaughton asked Goodpaster to minimize the amount of the team's creative effort that must go into analyzing the Rolling Thunder program or such proposals as the mining of the North Vietnamese harbors. Despite the insinuation that he should not study the effectiveness of the most controversial military measures taken or recommended so far, the guidance that Goodpaster received from McNamara permitted military planning based on the assumption that the United States would do everything it could. Goodpaster's reply to the question of whether the United States could win in Vietnam was a qualified yes. To win, the study argued, the administration must lift restrictions and controls on the use of military force, with the exception of prohibitions on a land invasion of North Vietnam, the use of nuclear and chemical weapons, and mass bombings of population centers. Short of those few prohibitions, Goodpaster assumed, the military would have complete freedom of action, including ground operations in Laos to cut the Ho Chi Minh Trail, a full-scale air campaign against the North, and offensive operations in the South aimed at the destruction of enemy units. Once the president approved Goodpaster's strategy, military actions would not be subject to restriction, delay, or planning uncertainties. In essence, Goodpaster told McNamara that the United States would have to remove virtually all restrictions on the application of conventional military power to win in Vietnam. Because McNamara's military objectives were undefined, and because he had not communicated frankly with Goodpaster concerning limits on the use of force, Goodpaster's study offered military advice in a vacuum of political guidance. McNamara even attempted to persuade Goodpaster to drop from his study all assumptions concerning the limitations of the U.S. effort and replace them with an assumption that the large-scale introduction of U.S. troops would not provoke intensified enemy efforts. Goodpaster replied that, without making assumptions about what level of force the U.S. was willing to commit, he could not tell McNamara whether the U.S. could win. He also argued that the estimate should be based on the enemy's capabilities rather than on unrealistic assumptions concerning enemy intentions. The American military commitment in Vietnam grew without a reconciliation of Goodpaster's and McNamara's fundamentally different conceptions of how to prosecute the war. McNamara did not forward the Goodpaster study to the White House, but the plan did reach McGeorge Bundy's military assistant, Colonel Richard Bowman, on July 21st. Observing that the study had received no endorsement from McNamara, Bowman described it as a non-study and passed it to Bundy as background for the discussions on Vietnam. 30 years afterward, McNamara identified but did not seem to understand his failure to connect additional troop deployments to a strategy for ending the war on favorable terms. Citing the superficiality of his discussions with Westmoreland in Saigon, McNamara was puzzled by his inability to have thought deeply and realistically about Vietnam and his failure to have considered alternative courses of action and their consequences. He placed a large measure of the blame on Westmoreland for not having provided answers to questions such as what military strategy and tactics should be followed, how the Viet Cong would respond, how many casualties the United States would suffer, what responses could be expected to U.S. actions, and when they would occur. But in 1965, McNamara neglected strategic thought and focused entirely on tactical changes. The Defense Secretary informed Westmoreland that the main purpose of his July 1965 trip was to receive the MACV commander's recommendations for the numbers of troops required by the end of the year, the time schedule for deployment, and the probable requirements for additional forces next year. McNamara's challenge would be to exact from Westmoreland a request consistent with the number of troops that the president was willing to approve. Before McNamara's departure, McNaughton had already drafted the report that McNamara would send to the president on his return. McNaughton's deputy, Adam Yarmolinsky, recalled that McNamara's trip was theater designed to justify decisions already made. On July 14th, as McNamara and his party departed for Saigon to discuss with Westmoreland the forthcoming troop deployments, the purpose of the use of force remained unclear. 2 days after he arrived in Saigon, McNamara received a literally eyes-only cable from his deputy, Cyrus Vance, confirming that the president intended to proceed with the deployment of 34 more battalions to South Vietnam because he feared that a troop deployment larger than that would kill the domestic legislative program. McNamara would, nevertheless, remain in Saigon for 3 more days of consultation. Indeed, having deepened American involvement in the war, according to a pattern determined by domestic political pressures, McNamara's charge was to return with a consensus behind a list of actions consistent with the president's desire to get the Great Society package through Congress. In the early 19th century, Clausewitz observed that the political object is the goal, War is the means of reaching it, and means can never be considered in isolation from their purpose. The Great Society, the dominant political determinant of Johnson's military strategy, had nothing to do with the war itself. As a result, the application of means continued to escalate without a vision of how military action might actually achieve the goals of the war. On July 20th, McNamara returned from Saigon and forwarded his prefabricated report to the president, describing the objective of military force as demonstrating to the enemy that the odds are against their winning. He concluded with an ambivalent call to arms. McNamara predicted that his proposal, if properly integrated and executed with continued vigor and visible determination, stood a good chance of achieving an acceptable outcome within a reasonable time in Vietnam. His recommendation reiterated those actions the president had already decided to support. U.S. ground force deployments would increase to 34 battalions, or, if South Korea failed to provide 9 battalions promptly, 43. Limitations on the air campaign would continue, and McNamara dropped actions that he had included in earlier papers, such as the mining of Haiphong Harbor. McNamara's trip to Saigon raised the level of congressional interest in Vietnam. While Wheeler was away with McNamara, the other chiefs met with members of the House Armed Services Committee and Chairman L. Mendel Rivers's office. The representatives wanted the JCS to provide them with a comprehensive estimate of the amount of force that the war would ultimately require. If the chiefs answered the questions directly and honestly, they might be able to foil the president's plans for softening up the public and the Congress upon McNamara's return from Saigon. Coach Johnson would have been proud of his team. When the representatives asked if mobilization was necessary, the officers avoided answering. Although Harold Johnson had already notified major army commanders to prepare for a one-year mobilization of reserve units and had outlined to them a specific program for increasing the strength of the army by 63 battalions, the army chief told the committee members that he didn't really know what his requirement was, now or in the future. After repeated questioning, Johnson replied that some 250,000 U.S. troops would be needed in Vietnam, about half the number he privately believed would be necessary to end the war on terms favorable to the United States and South Vietnam. McConnell refused to estimate the number of men the Air Force would require to satisfy the demands of the war. McDonald said that the Navy would require 40,000 more sailors, but did not state whether the increase would require mobilization of reserve forces. Although Green believed that the committee members must have deduced from the discussion the need for mobilization, the chiefs never made that requirement explicit. Near the end of the meeting, one of the legislators asked Green directly how many men would be needed to win the war in Vietnam. Amid the confusing and contradictory estimates of his colleagues, however, Green's estimate of 500,000 made no visible impression on the legislators. The questioning turned from troop requirements and mobilization to military action against North Vietnam. Rivers, a Democrat from South Carolina, took a nautical map of Haiphong Harbor out of a locked cabinet. Rivers and the committee's chief counsel, John R. Blanford, asked the JCS why they were not mining Haiphong Harbor and bombing fuel storage facilities in the port area. "Haven't you chiefs recommended that this be done?" Green deferred to McDonald and McConnell, who explained that the targets had been placed on a list, but that the attack times had not been specified. McDonald said that political factors, such as potential damage to neutral ships, had delayed them. Asked about other targets in the area, McDonald gave the same answer. Green thought that his colleague's statements were not truthful in light of repeated JCS recommendations to attack those targets and mine the harbor. But he remained silent. Rivers asked Green why surface-to-air missile sites and air bases had been left untouched. Green said that he had been greatly concerned about the need to hit both targets and had advocated hitting the surface-to-air missile sites from the day the first shovel had been struck into the ground to construct them. Green's direct response contrasted with the reticence of his colleagues. The chiefs as a whole had been less than forthcoming. Representative F. Edward Hebert, a Democrat from Louisiana, told them that they were highly respected, but warned that their credibility would suffer unless they provided Congress with their honest opinions. Rivers told the chiefs that they were creatures of the Congress and therefore have a duty to them as well as to the executive branch. Harold Johnson responded defensively, arguing that he owed allegiance principally to the president. Johnson reminded the representatives that under the National Security Act, the chiefs were principal military advisors to the president, the National Security Council, and the Secretary of Defense. Green told the congressman that the chiefs found themselves in a very difficult position between the committee and the administration. Representative William H. Bates, a Republican from Massachusetts, described the National Security Act as the worst one that Congress ever passed. Green recorded at the time that the chief's evasive answers had left the committee in a fit of frustration. Green experienced conflicting feelings during the consultation with the committee members. Sympathetic to his commander-in-chief in the April White House meetings, when LBJ seemed besieged by opponents of the U.S. role in Vietnam, Green was nonetheless astounded by how few of the facts regarding the situation seemed to be known to the people's representatives. Green's loyalty to the president and reluctance to contradict his colleagues, however, prevented him from giving the legislators his full assessment of the situation. 2 hours after the meeting, he called John Blanford. Green told Blanford what he declined to say in the meeting. The United States, Green said, was on the verge of a major war that would ultimately involve a minimum of 500,000 troops. The war would take at least 5 years, and the United States would suffer a large number of casualties. To set conditions for winning the war, the United States would have to undertake an immediate intensification of operations against North Vietnam and within South Vietnam. Green had given Blanford privately the assessment that the chiefs had failed to provide either to Congress or to the administration. With the administration deceiving the people and Congress about the depth of the American military commitment in Vietnam, the JCS were in a quandary. Although the Constitution designated the president as commander-in-chief of the military, each member of the JCS was sworn to